Welcome to another episode of No Ordinary Life, a podcast by Darko. I'm your host, Josh Monk, and I recently sat down with the manager of the Commonsal Muckoff downhill team, Thibaut Ruffin. Thibaut is a veteran in the downhill world. Getting involved in racing in the late 90s, he's seen the sport evolve into the dynamic and global phenomenon that it's become. As time has passed, his mission has slowly moved from focusing on his own racing career to managing race teams. Currently, he's managing arguably the fastest downhill team in the world, consisting of Miriam Nicole, Thibaut Daprella, Amaury Piron, Hugo Marini, and Tristan Lemire. Their domination over the last couple of years has been a spectacle to observe. The team seriously refuses to be anywhere other than on the top step. In this chat, Thibaut gives us some insight into his life as the manager of the team, as well as racing at the top level whilst carrying out this role. We learn about how he deals with not only his emotions and mindset throughout the season, but also the mindsets of the whole team and crew. It's also his birthday, so go say happy birthday to him. Enjoy the chat. Hello.
Yo.
How are you going, man?
I'm good, man. And you?
I'm not bad. I'm really cold.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, I'm not having a good time.
Are you sick or what?
I actually am. I've got like a weird chest infection out of nowhere. I went to a concert on Friday night and it was okay. But then I started feeling a bit crap. But then yesterday and today I've been coughing my guts up just like all day. It's like, this is pleasant. So
yeah, little chest infection called COVID, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I've tested twice and it was negative both times.
Oh, yeah?
Fuck, I don't even know what I have. So it's it is what it is. I mean, I'm just sitting down doing nothing. It's not like I'm doing any marathons, you know, today or tomorrow. Yeah. So I'm just relaxing. But anyway, how are you, man? How's it being home and relaxing of sorts?
Really good. Like we had a really good last month, lots of biking with friends and my brother in Quebec as well, which was good. And little COVID party as well. Like we came back from Whistler with a few friends to Quebec, and one of them had COVID and then just passed it to everybody. But to the ones at least, we didn't have it yet.
Okay.
Otherwise, okay. My girlfriend finally had it. And I had it back in March, like for Lord actually, and didn't catch it again. So that's all good.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, but again, it wasn't too bad. Like my girlfriend was just like, just coughing and a bit tired, but not too crazy, you know.
Mm. Well, actually, we just moved into this apartment like a week ago, and my girlfriend got COVID the day or a couple of days before we were supposed to move in, but she was completely asymptomatic for the whole time that she had COVID. So she was not sick at all. She didn't feel sick. She was just really frustrated because you couldn't do anything.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Fucking COVID, but whatever. I think just now it just really just a normal disease and nobody reads you.
Yeah. And I feel like we're getting to a point as well where people are kind of starting to take it less seriously, which is good and bad, right? I mean, good in the way that we're not so worried about, you know, the apocalyptic effect it's going to have on people. But then at the same time, if you're complacent, then some people who are at more, I guess, more at risk of getting sick will get sick. But I remember saying to myself like maybe a year and a half ago, I was like, I can't wait for the day that we start talking about COVID like we're talking about the flu. Like, oh, I had COVID last week, but I'm good now, you know.
Yeah, that's it. And it's just becoming this way, you know. We had like these friends were supposed to have a lot of dinner party together like a couple of weeks ago, and one of them had COVID. His girlfriend tested positive, and we're like, yeah, just let's meet, as it would be nothing, you know. We're gonna get it and just play Russian roulette or whatever. But yeah, again, no, nobody got bad, and I think it's just the way it is now. So yeah
it is. And speaking of parties, you've got your birthday coming up soon.
Yeah, in 15 days, 17 exactly.
Yeah. So any COVID parties planned?
Not really. Like, I didn't celebrate my birthday for a while. Like, we did did a fake one in while we were in Whistler with lots of friends. We went to Sushi Village and they were like, oh yeah, it's fucking Thibaut's 40. I'm not even 40. I'm gonna have 38. And yeah, we got a lot of free stuff and he got completely crazy. But he wasn't my brother at all. But that was funny. But yeah, I just basically celebrate the big ones. But I didn't even celebrate my 30s. But I will do for the 40. But I'm not sure. I'm looking forward to it very soon. Like this. Yes.
It's in the
30s as long as as possible.
Yeah, man. Oh, don't worry about it. It's far away from now. It's in the future.
Yeah.
That's but actually,
it's life.
Yeah, that's it, man. I think I'm edging on 30. I'm turning 28 in about turning 28 in February. And for me, I'm like, oh wow, I'm getting to 30. And it's funny because then one of my friends, super young, he was like, oh man, I'm gonna be 20 soon. I was like, what? Yeah, like that's okay. So it's just like you always feel either younger than someone or you feel older than someone. It's always just who you're talking to.
Yeah, that's insane. But then the older you get, the faster it gets. That's fucking insane, you know. I remember having 30 and the morning I woke up, I was like kind of depressed. I'm like, fuck, I'm 30, I'm old and it's not good. And then I'm like 38 now and fuck. But you know, still good. Like I still do what I wanna do, like life evolves and that's all good still. Like just I think I'm less stressed to get in 40 than in the 30s maybe.
That's good. Whatever. I mean, that's a good way to see it. I was watching some random YouTube short. It was like Kevin Hart interviewing John Travolta, and John Travolta's in his 60s now. And he said that his 10-year-old son asked him like, "Hey, you know, you're 60 something there. How do you feel about life?" And Travolta's like, "Oh yeah, well, I feel like I've accomplished a lot." And he said, "No. Like, how do you feel about life?" He's like, "Oh well, I feel like I'm in my 60s. I feel like I'm getting old, and I'm in the later stage of my life." And he said, "Oh, well, but how old were you 30 something years ago?" He was like, "Well, I was 30. He's like, "Does that feel like 30 years ago?" He's like, "Yeah, it's a long time." He was like, "Yeah, so you've got that much longer to go if you want to get to 90. Like, that's a long time to still have fun and stuff." And he was like, "You're 10 years old. Why are you saying such wise things, you know?" So I guess it just depends on how you look at it. Like my God, I was 17 like 2 days ago, but it's like, yeah, but it's going to be a while till I get to 50, for instance. It's gonna be like a long time till I get to 50. So I don't know. It's just how you see it, suppose.
Yeah, that's for sure. Like you have to take it like easy and look forward more than backward and not stopping doing whatever you do because you're getting old. Just the way I see it, you know, still partying, doing sports, having fun, and I just don't want to enter like in that old people like, just like having a house, just settling down, just not doing much anymore. Like I just want to still travel with my friends and biking all over the world and just find my girlfriend with everybody, but just not being stuck, you know. That's the main thing, because as long as when you start getting stuck, it's not good. I think you start feeling out, you know,
and absolutely.
just the way of life. And obviously it's not easy to be able to do that for everybody, but if you can do it, for sure you have to, I think.
Well, that's exactly it. Like if you have the opportunity to, it'd be crazy not to. And I feel like if you can't ride a bike anymore because you're too old, then you're old. Until then, you're not old, you know.
But that's fucking plenty of time, because my brother, for example, is still he rides a lot of moto, enduro, extreme enduro moto, and they go to insane places, you know. Some places I do some moto a lot less than them, but some places I know where I can follow them, and he still does it with people who are getting 60. And you know, they are not slowing them down, you know, when they go all together. So that's still good, and it's a push, and just helps to keep to stay motivated, and just thinking you're not dead after 50 or whatever, you know.
Yeah, there's a long way to go. So there's a lot to do, but
let's do yoga then.
Yoga. Well, speaking of age, and you know, I guess how far we come. from when we were kids. I mean, how old were you when you decided that you actually wanted to take mountain biking and I guess traveling the world mountain biking as a job in a serious way?
So I've always been in sports. I've been racing a lot of, I've been racing ski, alpine ski for a while before getting into mountain bike, just more nationally and just like, yeah, across countries, just touching France, like Italy, Andorra, and yeah, these few countries next to France. And yeah, at some point, I think it was back in 96 or 7, I think my parents just bought mountain bikes, and I started to ride mountain bikes with them and some friends. And I was like, yeah, that's fucking cool. And I like it. And got to see Worlds in Leger, I think, or was a World Cup, I don't know, in Leger back in these years. And I was like, yeah, that's insane. And I really want to do it, you know? And yeah, but, you know, at that point, bikes were already costing like super expensive. And I was like, yeah. Out with my parents, yeah, to get one, like earn a full-time job to try to get one. And they were like, yeah, you have to be good at school and yeah, get super good marks and stuff to get one. And I worked my ass off to get to the point they wanted to buy me one. And that was it. And I think I raced my first season in 98 or 99, somewhere around that. I'm losing it. It's a long time ago. And yeah, I was still doing ski at the same time, ski racing. And it was crazy because it was such a weird atmosphere in that sport. Like it was kind of really strict and kind of narrow-minded. Like coaches and everybody in that sport were kind of, if you want to be good at skiing, you have to think ski like 100% of the time, ski as many days as you can during the years, over a year, I mean. Mm-hmm. And for me, that was too much, even if I was at a pretty decent level and I think I had good potential. It was not the way I was seeing. I was not maybe enjoying it that much, even though I was loving to ski and doing slaloms and whatever racing. But everything that was all around it was just kind of toxic.
Hmm.
And yeah, I discovered that sport that was fun, where everybody was at the races, having fun, in a good atmosphere, and just more in a lot more relaxed way. Just yeah, pushed me into the direction and comforted me in the idea that I wanted to do that. And which was funny, it's the few years I combined high level ski and I would say my early career, if you could call it a career, in mountain bike, I had the best results I ever had in ski. And I was starting to get really good results as well in mountain bike, which helped me to get where I was a few years ago.
Yeah.
And in my career again, if you can create a career, because it's, you know, I was never paid to do bike properly. You know, I got I got parts, I got bikes and free stuff, but never a huge budget and not even salary to make it. You know.
Sure.
And but yeah, that's it, no?
Well, I mean, I think you can call it a career. I mean, you were what? You got into the World Championships when you were 17, right? In 2002.
Yeah, that was it. That was it, yeah. First, it's basically the first or second year I started to get decent results and be consistent in the top, the French top 10, 15. Remember, like, yeah, 2002, I've been like top, yes, I've been seventh at French champs overall. Like, there was all the big dogs from that time. Like, I think Barrel won. I think Cédric Grasse was just like a couple spots ahead of me. And there was all these guys that I looked as like the legend of the sport, like a few years before that, and I still did look like this way, like even after, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, "Yo, fuck yeah, fuck, I'm getting there," and yeah, that was so cool, and yeah, just started and yeah, just trying to get more professional. After that year, I ended up. I crashed in my first World Cup in Leger. I think it was the week after the World Championship in Austria, and mm-hmm. I got a shoulder injury, and I couldn't really get back to ski training in the fall season. And that was the question. Like, I wanted to still give it a shot at skiing, but I couldn't really ski until December, January that year. So I was like, yeah, that's no,
wow.
It's pretty compromised. And I was like, yeah, anyway, I'm not, I think at the bottom, I didn't really want to pursue that thing. And I was like, yeah, just let's do bike 100% and try to do good things, you know?
And then here we are.
And here we are. Yeah. Long time and lots of stuff, opportunities. Yeah.
Well, yeah, man.
That, and, yeah.
There's a lot of stuff that's happened, you know, especially, you know, whether it's been you racing as yourself or in a team, like for instance, the Commensal, you know, the Super Riders, and that had both you and your brother Gaetan and Miriam as well. And your father, Jean-Pierre, was the assistant manager to Kevin Olleman. So, I mean, it's always been, you know, from the very start, I suppose, at least almost your future into becoming a team manager of sorts. I mean, how was that kind of going from being under your father and Kevin's wing as a racer for Super Riders, and then kind of just moving up to, I guess, you know, maybe even riding addiction, you know, up into 2009?
Yeah, it was even earlier than that. Basically, the story, like, first and foremost, my parents have always been very involved in what we've done in our sports life, you know, obviously in our lives with my brother.
Yeah.
My brother was also racing ski when he was younger, and you know, our parents helped a lot making it happen, and it was the same with mountain bike. And yeah, between like, so yeah, the 2001 and 2002, we already set up a team with my parents and Damien Spagnolo parents. With Damien was silver medal at Champagne World Champs, I think, mm-hmm. 2009, second behind Danny Hart, who had that crazy runs that everybody seen. But that was that guy, and we were teammates and friends back in the day from the same place. He comes from the same 10 minutes from where I lived at that time.
Yep.
And so we were not completely stranger to set up a team, but it was like just a small setup to help us go racing.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, we both went to different teams, national teams. And came 2006, I broke my ACL so in the knee. And at the very beginning of the World Cup season, and I think it was the second race, and yeah, basically I was out for the whole season because, yeah, I had to undergo surgery and all the rehabilitation that comes with it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, after a couple of weeks being like devastated because I couldn't race my bike and do what I love, I was like, okay, I need to find something to do. And that was that idea in the part of my mind that I wanted to set up my program for the next 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I took advantage of that time off or at the hospital and stuff to build my program. And that was it. I need to turn this notification. Can you hear the
WhatsApp? No, I can't actually hear anything.
Okay, that's good. Sorry, the notification. But
no, you're all good, man.
Give
me a chance to cough.
Yeah, that's all good. And yeah, a couple months, so I got injured in June. A couple months later, in August, I went to Eurobike with on clutches and got to see Browns and try to show my project and explain to them what I wanted to be. And got a deal with Ironos at that time was like the brand of the moment with Samuel kicking ass and it was a crazy brand you wanted to write for, and it ended up working along with a few other cool brands, and the project came to life. And and yeah, just for, so there was obviously my parents still involved, my dad, my mom. Kevin was my former mechanic in my previous team.
Yes.
Was keen to follow us in that project. And yeah, that was the beginning of Riding Addiction, actually. And
wow.
2007 was the first season. And yeah, I've been racing on my own for 3 years. 2 years on Iron Horse, and then it kind of shut down, and not really sure what happened with the brand, but yeah, end of 2008 the big team came to an end, obviously, like the little rider support as well. And yeah, I came to the commercial guys and say, yeah, I've got nowhere to go, and please help me. I was kind of really, please help me, guys. And ended up having frames from them. And like, I don't know, 13 years later, we're still there.
It is crazy, isn't it? I mean, it's such a long-standing relationship. And it's, I know you kind of hear that brands, or at least teams, they go from, let's say, apparel sponsor to bike sponsor, to, and then people jump out of a team, they come back in and stuff. And it's always so transient. But to hear that you guys have been in the same relationship for that long is like a really cool thing to experience, especially in such a fleeting industry.
That's so cool. And I mean, the relationship is great, and it keeps evolving over the years. And it's fortunate now we came to a point that it's been almost forever. And and I think Commensal and ourselves just wouldn't see it any other way. I think we kind of, I could say, committed to life with them, and just things gets only better with time, can't complain, and it's great to have their support, and having a brand also that understand racing and see it the same way as we do in the team. I mean, it's really important.
It seems like you guys are always on the same page. Like, you know, I've had the privilege of meeting you guys in person a few times and seeing you in action at the rounds, and it's just like this little, it's a big family, really. You know, you eat together, you all drink Rickal together, which is just, it's too much for me to handle. It's so rank, man.
Oh, for us too. That's it. Yeah, like, that's the big atmosphere. We look for the same thing. We love racing. We love winning. We love partying. And yeah, you know, this year we came pretty strong at all of it. that was kind of a memorable year for sure.
It was definitely memorable. do you think that incredibly close feeling of family is something that's kind of contributed to the intense success of this team?
I think, I'm not sure if it's the family thing or just the atmosphere, but I think it's kind of related, and for sure, like, I mean, being so close from day one with everybody, and even from now, like, we have Amaury, Thibaut, and a few other that came in the team in the meantime, but we all went to, we came from the same, we knew each other at the beginning, and we were all close friends, and I think that was important in the process. And you know, sometimes I kind of worry that maybe we would come to a point that it won't be possible to get the same luck maybe at making it happen, but for sure it's been a huge help to have that relationship and just, I would say, closeness with all these guys, you know.
And Max, of course, you know, just being so passionate and being there like every single round, that's it's pretty special.
Yeah, for sure. You don't see like many bus, like back brand bus going at the races, and even less at every races.
And every
and party. Yeah, I think, you know, I think it came to a point that the brand is strong. It's been there for forever, and you just want to enjoy it and be part of it, you know, and you deserve that, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And being able to bring in some victories and good times, it's even better.
Some victories, yeah. Just some.
Yeah, if you want.
As you said, with, you know, you and the team, you've kind of known each other for a while, especially Miriam, you know, you were back in a team with her, you know, with the Commissar Super Riders. Do you, I guess, looking back now, could you kind of see, without sounding too dramatic, greatness or massive success in her back around that time? Were you able to kind of see what her potential success would become?
Yeah, definitely. I would say, like, I was. So she was in the national giant team at the end of 2009, and that team shut down, and she was like hanging out at the last World Cup of the year in Austria. We both remember it very well, and she was like, "Yeah, I have no team, no opportunities for next year," and I was like, On my side, I had like no budget, you know. I was kind of relying on working during winter and selling my bikes to do the season, you know.
Wow.
And and I was like, yeah, I want to try and make it work with you. And that was definitely like I knew she could be fast. I have no idea if at that time if she could win World Cups or winning world championships, but I was pretty sure that she could get on some podiums and anyway help that little team to get bigger, you know, and kind of just go to the next step or dimension, if we can say. Mm-hmm. And it was a lot more than expected in the end, because I think 2 years later she got lots of podium. I think first year she was in the team, she won the first or second World Cup qualifying and ended up breaking a derailleur or something at the joint finals. And I remember watching her, I think that was Freecaster back in the time. And so she was first in the first split again finals. And just we saw in the middle that she broke a derailleur and she was just cruising down. After the run, she said that she wanted to stop. So much, she was gutted, you know, she was so gutted that she wanted to stop, and she still ended up like fourth. And for us, it was still amazing. But yeah, I'm pretty sure it was the season opening, and I was like, yeah, fuck, she still fought with a broken derailleur like halfway up, you know.
That is impressive.
That was cool, and yeah, next year she won her first World Cup and obviously first World Cup for the team, and that was insane, you know.
Does it ever change that feeling when you win a World Cup? I mean, obviously you guys have won so many that one could argue that you might start to feel complacent with the victories, but does it ever change?
No, I mean, that winning feeling is still insane. Like, just, yeah, still get crazy emotions, and I would say in every single win, you know. Still we get pretty high like most of the time. I would say like everything that is not victory, I mean second spot, third spot, or even podiums sometimes taste bitter for us, and I'm always like kicking my ass in the way that we shouldn't be I would say negative or not happy with a podium, because like most of the other team would pay or would do whatever they want to make it happen, and but sometimes it's sad, but we're maybe too used to win, and obviously that's the only thing that counts and we want.
Yeah,
but we should kind of review our expectation and cherish what we get, you know. Like number one example is Léger. We were like kind of depressed, honestly, after the races, both races, because obviously both could have won. I mean, even Thibaut was in the pace to win it during practice, but just couldn't find the couldn't put it together during the race run. I mean, and yeah. That was the same for Miriam and yeah, Amory was missing a few things too, but we still got like second in the world and third in the world in the women. And and man, that's still huge, you know. And and at first we were not happy, you know. And that's not good. I mean, I'm not proud of that, you know.
It reminds me of what Ricky Bobby's father said in Talladega Nights. You know, if you ain't first, you're last.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, I can understand that, right? I mean, you guys are really just at the absolute apex of racing and you constantly get to the top. And so it must be kind of like, okay, what have we done wrong this time to not be the perfect run? So I can imagine that there'd still be a lot of self-pressure, more than pressure from other people to be on top.
Yeah, and for sure, you know, when you're there, you just want to stay there and do whatever it takes. And, you know, the whole team, riders and everybody has been super committed in having the perfect season, I would say. And it's still like a perfect season we had, and still the best in the team history. But yeah, you know, it's, I think the more time goes, the more pressure we have, because some like people are watching at us as what we probably are, like as the best team, one of the best team in the world, if I could say. And
that's pretty fair.
You know, we just want to win so bad that sometimes it's hard to go over it when it doesn't happen. And you just try to understand what was wrong and what we did wrong and what we can correct for the next years. But again, we have to lose sometimes, because if we only be winning, no, that would be too easy. And there would be no reset, no questions or nothing, and nothing would be hard to evolve and push ourselves further. So yeah, pretty sure like lots of teams want our spot, and lots of riders want Amory's spot and Miriam's spot and all of this. So we just need to kick our ass harder and make it happen, you know.
God, don't kick it too hard. You might break something. I mean, you're kicking it pretty hard. I mean, and there are definitely teams and races that are, you know, that are really vying for that top spot. I mean, the Santa Cruz team, the Syndicate is just doing such a great job with Greg, Laurie Greenland and the rest of them. And of course, Jackson Goldstone. I mean, they are just doing their absolute best at the moment. And they're, you know, they're definitely vying for that top spot. And then you've of course got Camille Balanche, who's just completely, I feel like she's just kind of exploded the past maybe 2 years. And then also to know that she raced Val d'Isol with basically a freshly reconstructed shoulder is just horrifying, yet amazing to know. So, I mean, it's definitely fertile ground for a lot of competition. And it's so cool to see that all categories as well are just as interesting to watch. But yeah. I mean, it seems like you guys are just, yeah. I mean, you really are just the top team to beat. And that's, I don't think that's overstating it at all. But another thing that I could imagine with being a team and also, you know, keeping on top, whether it's racing, and then also just how you communicate with the people who are interested in you, you know, your social media accounts and then keeping the races in front of a camera. Of course, that's kind of something that's, I feel like, happened a lot more, I'd say, since maybe 2010, 2011 with smartphones coming out and then all these different platforms. Has there been a shift in the way that you kind of have to deal with your emotions when things don't go your way or things do go your way, because you know that there's basically always someone watching, there's always a camera on you? Do you kind of have to navigate how you initially react to certain events?
Well, it's still the tough part of the sport, and I think the approach of the after race, but anyway, I would say we've never been like too expressive from the outside, just about like having a bad face. But no, it's still like hard, you know. Sometimes it's still stronger than me and stronger than people involved, you know. And when you did bad and you get beaten hard, you know, it hurts, and it's hurt the whole team, and I think we all feel it. And for sure, I mean, yeah, I think people somehow understand that it's sports, but and it's part of the game to be sad about what you accomplished and obviously did not accomplish. Mm-hmm. But again, it's always pretty quick after races that you feel bad for a few minutes, half an hour at max, and yeah, after you just turn it to good mood and look to the next one, and and yeah, I mean, you know, Léger was again the same story. You know, we were not happy of the outcome, and we still had a pretty huge party after it. And, that was the next hour that was tricky, and then we just kind of you know, a few hugs, few tears in the back pits, and then we go again. You know,
just keep going. That's awesome. And of course, like everyone in the team would have to kind of, you know, navigate their own feelings, understand how they're feeling about it, deal with it and move on. But I feel like maybe where it differs for you is that you are the team manager. So you kind of have to take a lot of other people's feelings into account as well. So is that another challenge for you? Or do you just consider that kind of part of your job? It's just like, all right, yeah, I've got to go see how everyone else is doing, see how the atmosphere is.
No, for sure. And, you know, I should be not working, but being as a model for them, you know. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't be the one that is not happy and having a bad face, you know, after a race or whatever. And I'm far from perfect on this, and working on it big time. But even if I'm not happy with maybe rider road or whatever, you know, I come from this, and I know you can't always control everything, and totally understand it. And I think I always have like the good words and what it takes to try to make to make them feel better, you know. Mm-hmm. I've never been like I'm not sure the right word in English, but a big speaker, you know. Not often real. No, I'm bad at expressing how I feel and all of this, but I think it never goes too far. But I think I'm not too bad at telling the right thing at the right time, I would say.
Sounds like a good quality to have.
Yeah, but not easy again. But it doesn't work 100% of the time. Like I remember like a few times like arguing so bad with Miriam because I told her the not the right thing after, I don't know, a qualifying or most of the time qualifying she had, and she had bad. And like for example, like Leo Gong, Lenzer ride in Switzerland this year, she rode a really mellow qualifying and she ended up third or fourth in a not so good time compared to what she's capable of. Mm-hmm. And was just like, yeah, it's good, but it's not your level. It's not where you can be. And it wasn't the right thing to do, to say apparently from her, but I'm not sure it was completely the worst. And it was good because he kicked her ass and she ended up winning by a huge margin the next day. So, one thing in the other, it worked out.
Well, sometimes it's just a bit of tough love and it works out.
Yeah. And you need to, we have to be careful with riders because depending on the moment you go to them and the way they feel. And obviously, women riders are a bit more tricky to deal with on the mental side of things because, you know, they do create the things in that sport. And I assume it's, they do huge, like from the first to the last, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I would do that if I would be a woman, you know. Mm-hmm. And have huge respect for that, and yeah, maybe sometime we need to be a little easier on them.
Yeah, okay. And,
More tricky, because they have a lot more things to deal with than men have to deal with for racing and you know, women things.
Sure. I would say. Yeah, I mean, maybe not easier on them is the best description, but maybe just a different approach per se.
Yeah.
So just something that is just more whether it's understanding or just more collaborative, even, you know, working.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I guess that's, of course, like, that's just one of the things of being a manager, just, you know, navigating people, personalities, schedules, all the fun stuff. I mean, what do you like most about being a manager, though?
I just like the sport, you know. I mean, obviously, I'm beyond proud to be to this being my team, you know. Mm-hmm. And I just like, I don't take it necessarily as a job, you know, just my passion from since I discovered that sport. And I would have never believed to be where we are.
Yep.
And you know, I wouldn't say there are things that I prefer compared to others. Definitely things that I don't like in it, especially like when it comes to sponsor relationship or riders relationship that we have to end, you know, for any reasons. But it's never good, because, you know, it's only good memories we have in the past. And if things just doesn't work to continue this relationship, it always hurts, you know.
Yeah.
And if it would be only me, you know, we'd be working for the same people forever. But again, we need to consider like so many things to be performant. So. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I would say that's the main thing I don't like in the process.
Yep.
But other than that, like everything is great, and I'm lucky to have like a super good and efficient team on my back, you know. Yeah. And you know, my brother do a huge job, like, and it was great to have him alongside with me over the past, like, for more than 10 years now doing this. Mm-hmm. It helped us to keep being racing while we were doing that team. And it was even more working with good results, you know. So it was really good to still have fun at loving what we do first, which is riding and racing. Mm-hmm. And bringing that team to the top. So it was a show.
And you've of course got your father still kind of helping you out, and also your mum. What was the transition like from when you were on a team racing and your father was the team or the managing assistant or assistant manager, team manager, to becoming a team manager of a team and then still having him there? Is there a bit of backseat driving where he's kind of help, like not telling you what to do, but giving you some tips on how to do stuff? Like, do you rely on him much for that, or is he just there to support you when you need it?
Yeah, it was, how would I say? Obviously, even basically my parents were both the managers, and I've always been the, you know, we always talked a lot of the team things internally within the family, you know, dinner, lunch, whatever. It's been a long discussion about team things over the years, and still now, you know, now that they are a little less involved, but still around, because it's their life too, and they've been there from day one, and we don't want to take it away from them. And as long as they want to come at the races, and obviously their help is always welcome. You know, my dad is still driving the truck, and with my brother, and mm-hmm. and it's super helpful, and still like doing the little thing that nobody has time to do at the races. Mm-hmm. And that's good. So yeah, nothing,
you know, never really changed on the way we approach. For sure, the last few years, the whole thing became a lot more professional, and we're still trying to go through the next step for the years to come.
Mm-hmm.
But the basics are still the same, I would say.
Yeah. Okay. And of course, you've stopped racing, I suppose. I think Portugal was probably your last proper race, if I'm correct. That would have been March.
I still gave it a try, a few tries over the past 2 years, but I've been, I don't know. I think I was riding pretty decently, but yeah, I turned back as a kid, and as long as there was timing, I was really riding so shit. So I'm not sure what I was doing wrong. And with, you know, I've got a lot of experience, and that should not happen. But I think probably like a few little injuries along the way, and
mm-hmm.
obviously a lot less time for training, and the fact also to not wanting to be injured again, and we have like that big thing to drive, and mm-hmm. yeah, not allowed to be injured. So probably, yeah, just taking a little less risk, and yeah, just maybe now just wanting to take it really good from the other side, and trying to go through the next step. And I would say like the next step requires that we, even if I said that we don't take it as a job, that we take it more as a job, and just try to make it work in the best way possible, you know?
Yeah. And was it kind of a sad, I mean, like how did it feel when you kind of went, okay, like I'm going to focus more on managing and less on racing. I'm kind of, yeah, just going to do less racing. Was that a heavy moment considering, you know, how much racing has been a part of your life?
Not really. You know, I've been, I think, pulling the rope for a good few years.
Okay.
But yeah, I was still feeling kind of capable of making it. You know, mm-hmm. I wasn't looking for World Cup wins or whatever, but still like decent results. But yeah, I think trying and just seeing that kind of a frustration to be racing, but having like 50% of the capacities to do it. For sure, I had the best bikes, the best components, and everything around it, and the best mechanics, and that mm-hmm. was kind of bringing yeah. everything to me on the plate, I would say. But on my side, not being able to train 100% and be like 100% fit to race at a World Cup and be 100% competitive, and at the same time be fit enough to not take risk doing this. I just came to the point that I was like, yeah, okay, I'm done, and that's totally fine. I did everything I wanted to do. I enjoyed for 20 plus years, and yeah, got decent results over the years, and yeah, that was totally fine. I mean,
okay. And then now I suppose your focus is shifted towards still kind of embodying that competitive spirit, but then just, yeah, embodying it by focusing on someone else in your team to kind of bring them to their best as well. So it's almost like you're kind of transitioning that focus to someone else outside yourself.
Yeah. And bearing the nervousness twice more than when you were racing. It's great. Funny because when I and my brother were racing,
mm-hmm.
You know, the stress was like so much less. I mean, yeah, during race weekends, you know, we were kind of thinking about our race, and mm-hmm. and when we got down in finals, there was still like an hour to go before Amory or the top guys were racing, and that was maybe that time that worked most racing. But now you're just racing all over the weekend. and that's it. But it's still good because we lived some crazy good moments. I mean, all racing.
Yeah.
I think the World Cup in Lecce in 2019. Yeah, 19. That was great. Like the whole team qualified. My brother got his World Cup best. I think he got 29th. I think he beat me at the World Cup for the first time, and I got 30th, like just right behind him.
Bastard.
Thibaut won in the juniors, and Amaury killed it in the elite. And I think Miriam was injured at that time, I think. But you know, it was like a really good group results. Obviously, we won the team and in front of all our friends, because Léger is 2 hours from the team HQ, and it's where we live, you know. And like we had great memories because of it, and that's so cool.
Yeah, well, great memories then in 2021 in Léger, when you had like a football stadium worth of people just celebrating Thibaut's victory, and then of course, like, you know, just this year, that was biblical. I can't even imagine. I can't imagine I was there, but I can't comprehend just how many people were there stampeding the finish line. I mean,
it's insane, and hopefully nobody died.
But well, it reminded me of like, you know, the Lion King, when there's the big stampede of wildebeest, and then one of the, I think it's like Mufasa, basically gets trodden by the lions. Like it was like that by the wildebeest. It was just like that, because they were all just stampeding down this hill. It was like the dust was everywhere. I was like, wow, this is just like a cinematic moment.
That was so next level. Yeah, that's insane. And the sports is good. I mean, obviously, like this year we had like the best. The best races, and Léger has been insane. Even Lourdes has been great, and a few others. It was it becomes so popular, and it's so good to see. And the fans love it. I mean, every single people that has been in Léger like must have said like, wow, what is it, and how good it is, you know, and. And that's cool, and I hope it will just keep growing. But I think Léger was the most 100k people during finals, that's insane. That's
it was a spectacle to watch. And I was chatting about this with my friend actually the other day. He said, "I bet you like any amount of money that a good majority of these people have never touched an actual downhill bike." It's like,
oh yeah.
That's an interesting.
That's for sure. I mean, it's probably hits, because for sure, like they got friends who probably had already ride a bike, and they were like, yeah, just come to that to see that event. It will be sick.
Exactly.
Yeah, that was it probably, because if it would be like 100,000 people that would actually be buying DH bikes. You shouldn't be too bad as getting huge sponsor deal and stuff.
It'd be all right.
Even if it's decent, but it's the next step, I would say. But for sure, I mean, this will bring kids to ride bikes and race bikes.
Exactly.
That's for sure, you know. And, you know, it was the same for me like 20 years ago, 20 plus years ago when I watched that race. You know, there was like, if it was, I don't know, 10k people watching the World Champs back in the days, that was the maximum.
Yeah.
And I still found it so cool to race and to watch, and like, yeah, something that should be too cool to do. And it's the same with a lot of people that like racers now that have seen these races when they were younger and are racing now. And yeah, all the 100k of people, that should be like quite a few coming out of it.
As a team manager, I'm guessing that maybe you personally are not, you know, scouting for, you know, young, like especially young talent, but let's just say there's a young rider out there who is getting better and they're racing, they're doing really well, and they kind of are deciding that this is the path they want to take. I mean, how does a young rider go about, you know, getting recognized by people on a, let's not say a World Cup team, but, you know, how do they get recognized on a local level or at a national level? Is it now a lot of social media that they have to jump into? Is it obviously get good results and, you know, be a good person? I mean, how does a young kid get recognized to the point where they can, yeah, just I guess get further and further to a professional career. Obviously, it's a big question.
I think which is good for that new wave of kids. That's for sure. Now they have, like, from a young age, access to crazy good bikes, which help them to ride better, faster, and younger, obviously, compared to what was back in the days, even for the Amores and the riders for that age when they were young, like, bikes were not good, and or at least not to die for small people and kids, you know. And when you get to bike parks and the big ones, you see, like, such small kids riding bikes and riding them so fast already. That's so cool. And for sure, like, obviously there will be more and more coming up, and the luck is, I would say, as teams and brands are looking more and more into the what's coming up, and from through their distributors, satellites team or stuff like that, they have people like a bit looking around and paid to see what's coming up. So and more like development team within the big team coming up too.
Yep.
So for sure, they have more luck to get there, but it's again, on top of that, there would be a handful of riders that would be picked up in a team, like when you take it as a rate. And the key is riding, having fun, being nice. and obviously social media helps to get known, I would say, but I wouldn't recommend kids to be on social media like the whole day to the views, you know,
and sure,
it kills you. So yeah, just need to ride to find the right balance, you know.
Absolutely.
But again, I would say, as long as you're young and I would say 10, 12, 14, just ride your bike as much as you want, have fun, send it. and then if there's something, probably people will come at them.
I think that's a really important thing you said as well, about not worrying so much about the social media outcomes, at least. Like, put stuff into social media, but don't believe your worth based off, you know, how many likes or views you get. And actually, Rachel Strait said something similar when I asked her about that. She said that people should definitely not value themselves off how many likes they get, especially, you know, if they felt like they did something really cool on a bike, posted it, and then got no likes. Like, that doesn't mean that their own victory was not valuable, you know. So
no, for sure.
I think that's a really important thing.
We definitely need to leave it kind of aside. For sure, it's a tool, you have to use it, but again, it's not a necessity again, because if a young rider kicks ass and do a few races around there, people will know that, and even if it does, like, taking one that is a bit less good than, and as I don't know, a million views on Instagram or whatever, and another one who is faster but has no Instagram account,
yeah,
that'd still be the faster one who will get the spot, you know,
for sure.
So
as a team manager, what do you find to be what do you see as, like, the most positive quality from a racer? What's something that really stands out to you as, like, okay, that's a quality in a racer that I will always appreciate or always look for when I'm trying to, you know, form a relationship with someone?
Depending on where we want to pick that, that's, I forgot the word you were talking about, but
the quality or
quality. it came away over my mind, but yeah, just depending where you want to be. But for us, as, like, I mean, our team, and we really look into
people that anger to win, mm-hmm. And would win at, let's say, almost no cost. And that's at the end what would make the difference. But at the same time, you don't have to be in bad world to become it, you know, to be that person, you know. You can be nice and be and have the anger to win, you know.
Yes.
And Amory is definitely that person, I would say. And he wants to win like nobody, and yeah, doesn't prevent him to be the nicest guy around and have a good relationship with everybody, you know.
He's definitely a good example. I mean, he's a wonderful person. He's absolutely hilarious. He's a party animal, but then he's also just so steel-eyed when it comes to his focus on winning. Yeah. And it's just like he becomes a different person between when he's not racing and when he is. And that's such a special personal sure. and, quality to have.
And talking of that no quality that we were talking earlier, that being really pissed when you're not winning.
Mm.
It's definitely pissed when it's not winning. And it starts from second. So there's no other spots really that make him happy, you know.
Mm. Yeah. That can be
that makes the difference, you know. That's most of the time, I would say.
Yeah. And so we spent some time describing Amory. How do you think the team would describe you if they were, you know, if they were to be asked by me right now, and I said, how would you describe Thibaut? What do you think they'd say?
On the IG account of the team, my emoji instead of my name is a bear. So like a big bear, I would say.
As in, like, it'll cuddle you or it'll maw you to death or both?
No, I'm more cuddle and big guy, not really expressive. struggling to express.
Funny. Okay.
Should be somewhere around it.
Okay, so it's not that scene from The Revenant where Leonardo DiCaprio gets like torn apart. Okay, that's good to know. Yeah. It makes me feel safer already.
A nice beer.
Nice, man. And I mean, I guess, I mean, bears can get stressed. I mean, as we talked about before, you know, there's a lot more stress that you take on, you know, with dealing with your own stuff, but then also having to kind of deal with other people's stuff as well. I mean, how do you deal with that? Is that something that you just kind of learn as you, you know, go through the years of being a manager, or is it kind of new every time there's a new stress event per se?
No, for sure. I think it's a constant learning, you know. Again, been talking with the tech guys and did kind of a meeting in the last few days about what we did good and what we did bad this year, and how can we evolve for next year and all of this. And
mm-hmm.
and it's the same along the way. It's been the same over like the last 10 years, you know. We learn and we get better every week. I mean, like it's a constant learning thing, you know. And I wouldn't say there's a school for it or whatever. There might be some really good lesson or training for it that maybe I should take part at some point if I find some time that could still be really interesting and
mm-hmm.
would permit myself to evolve and yeah, but just yeah, don't take anything for granted and just be eager to learn and to move in the right direction, I would say.
And do you ever look back on previous seasons, I guess, as your own performance as a manager, not even just when it comes to, you know, dealing with your and other team members' stress, but just as a manager in general, do you ever look back and kind of go, okay, well, I really liked how I did this and I don't like how I did that, and you kind of work based off hindsight?
Yeah, sure. You know, you take your experience into consideration, that's for sure. And definitely you pick. Yeah, it's always been like situation that worked, and you kind of encounter back like a few years later that you say, oh yeah, we had this back in the days, and we did this, and it worked. It doesn't, and you just try to make it work. but just yeah, figuring out the best way out of it and yeah, using the right tools, I would say.
Yeah, and do team managers talk in terms of how they kind of deal with stuff like that, or is it everyone kind of keeps to themselves? What's the personality like, or at least the culture, I suppose?
I wouldn't say there's many big communication between team managers on the way they do things. Mm-hmm. I have some friends, like former riders that our team managers know, that we maybe share a bit more. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, I'm not sure. I don't really want to give the key of the success to anybody else. And probably others have things that they do better than we do, and that they probably don't want to share because that would make us better and and so on, you know. So no, not really. I wouldn't say that we share much. We speak for sure. We have good relationship between all team managers, mm-hmm. but yeah, on my side, I don't go like too much into details with them.
Fair enough. So it's kind of like trade secrets in a way. It's like, I won't show you. Yeah. Like I won't show you how the magic
potion.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you know, with everything that's happening, you know, going into next year, we know we've got Discovery taking over with instead of Red Bull and such. That's just, of course, one thing. But I mean, what are you looking forward to most for next year or next season, despite it starting halfway through 2023?
Just looking, knowing what's going to really happen, you know, or the whole look of it will be, you know. Because we are all a bit in the air now, and but I'm not too much afraid about it, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to some people, maybe, also some brands and team, whatever. You know, I trust in these guys. I think they're all like former riders for most of them.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't imagine that they invest so much into the sports and pick it up from Red Bull to make something worse. And for sure, imagine it would take like a couple of years to really set everything up and be perfect, I would say.
Mm.
But yeah, I'm kind of, I'm confident about them doing a good job, I would say, for sure.
That's some comforting words, I think. I have a feeling that, you know, you see again, like pink bike comments are just most of the time they're pretty ridiculous. But a lot of people are like freaking out about it. And then especially, you know, we hear about Red Bull handing over the reins to Discovery and then the Riders Union team forming and such. And I think a lot of people kind of saw the Riders Union forming as a knee-jerk reaction to Discovery. But of course, like a Riders Union has always, I think it's been in discussion for a very long time before they even knew that there was a potential takeover from Discovery. So, I mean, should people, I don't think people should be really worried per se. I mean, as you said, you know, they're taking it over and they wouldn't just throw it into the ground if they did such a thing. It wouldn't be good and it wouldn't be in their interest. So
that's for sure. But like all these riders union, even team managers union that we have, like team managers group and association that we have for 2 years now, and that will become more official in the next few months as awesome. like a proper entity, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Same in the cross country, or yeah, there's a few things like setting up, and the good thing in all of this and with ESO group, it's that they are listening what we want. For sure, they won't give us all we expect, and they won't go everywhere we want them to go. But at least, and compared to back in the days with UCI and even Red Bull, we have our word to say as teams. Riders representative already had their words to say with the UCI, but I think even more now with ESO, that since they, I think they have a better understanding of the sport and what we expect. And yeah, riders, just I think they thought that it was the right time to build something stronger than in the past, that having two riders representative selected in a kind of a random way.
Mm-hmm.
Now they just like it's more like coming from every riders, and they're gonna like the right guys to the right people to do it, and who have time to do it, and yeah, because it's a job. I mean, it's you can't really be like one of the best riders in the world and take that job. Because I really think it's a kind of a job, because it's a lot of, it would take it a lot of take them a lot of time. So
yeah
but again, they want and they listen to us. It already started since a few months now, and I mean, they are here for the good of the sport, and for sure we want the best for it, as well as teams and riders, and I'm confident.
That's good. No, I am as well. I think people were thinking a little bit too apocalyptically about it. They're kind of like, oh, this is it. You know, Red Bull had the soul, and now they're ripping the soul out. It's like, well, you know, give it a chance. You know, it's still
for sure. But just the bad. For sure, they're gonna have a huge challenge in their TV product, because Red Bull did really good over the past few years, and they had that great crew at the events with Rob, Elliot, and Tracy, Claudio. All these guys, they were the voices of the sport, and they were doing such a good job. And it's a shame that they're not in it anymore. I hope that it could change in the future. But I'm pretty sure like Red Bull wouldn't drop Rob for
a while, at least, you know, that he's
because he's so good, you know. But you know, in some way, these guys are kind of driven by the World Cup, and that's the pinnacle of the sport. And I would say it's less; it won't be as fun as like commenting in a Red Bull hard line compared to a World Cup. Is a lot less excitation. And and I hope this guy could change their mind, and I hope Discovery would be open enough to get a look at that. But again, it's just means like a huge battle between both parts, and I just from the bottom of my heart, I would really love to get these guys on the broadcast again, because they've been so great. I mean, nothing to say about it, you know.
I mean, really, they are just the voice of the sport. All I can say is good luck to whoever is following in footsteps. Like, it's got to be someone good, and it's got to be someone knowledgeable, charismatic, funny, engaging. Like, it can't just be someone who's, you know, like this. So for instance, this happened in the Olympics. There was a rock climber commentator called Charlie Bosco, and he is pretty much the voice of IFSC climbing competitions. But then they had this different commentator for the Olympics, and he was just saying the same kind of things over and over again, like, oh, this is a textbook performance, this is one for the history books, this is textbook and everyone went like, who is this guy? So you really have to make sure that whoever is jumping over, well, not jumping over, but following in the footsteps of someone so celebrated, sure. Like, they just have to be in that caliber, otherwise it's just going to be such a
I would say this is the tricky thing, because they won't have much room for mistake. And if the first few events aren't as exciting as it was, like, fans would be like, think bike's gonna get crazy, and you know it is, you know.
Yeah, but I just hope that Josh Briceland is a random celebrity commentator. I think he'd be amazing.
Yeah, just nobody would understand what he says, but actually I won't, but every French people won't.
Yeah.
But yeah, that would be funny for sure.
We'll just have subtitles underneath. It's not a problem.
Yeah.
Cool, man. Well, look, it's been like an hour and 15 minutes. It's been an awesome chat, and I really appreciate, you know, everything that you've given some insight into. It's been really cool.
Thank you too. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you again, and we'll speak soon.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, but I'm 100% sure I'd collapse from exhaustion or stress if I were in his position. His dedication to managing the team to the best of his ability, learning from his own actions and really understanding each member of the team and working with their personalities sounds pretty invaluable to the team's success. The Commensal Markov team is seriously a family unit, and that camaraderie coupled with consistency is something that should be celebrated in such a fleeting and transient industry. I hope you enjoyed this episode with Thibaut. Let us know what you found interesting about him and the team. I'm your host, Josh Monk, and this has been No Ordinary Life, a podcast by Darko.